Chapter 6. The Revision. The work that needs to be done, and which God calls me to do, if left undone, might hinder the progress of our cause, more than my teaching could advance it. Therefore, I leave all for Christ. Mary Baker Eddy, 1889. A member of Mrs. Eddy's primary class in November 1888 wrote in retrospect that in the classroom Joshua Bailey and his son Frank were of interest, one gray-haired, the other a bright boy of 12, and a most apt student of Christian Science. The teacher found Frank's father an apt student also, for she gave Joshua Bailey a very important assignment before making him editor of the journal the following January. Shortly after the close of this class, the teacher asked Mr. Bailey to assist her in her next revision of the textbook. He was to read it carefully, sentence by sentence, and without changing her wording, rearrange sentences topically to bring together scattered passages on the same subject. No project could do more to enlarge the understanding of an avid new student, and Joshua Bailey entered upon his task with enthusiasm. In his reminiscences, he wrote, quote, "As I weighed and compared and pondered and sought the subtle relations of the thought, it seemed to me that I was as one with a mass of threads of the most delicate and beautiful colors that were to be laid together by their shades." End quote. In the summer of 1889, the teacher had a contract drawn up giving Bailey a royalty on future editions of Science and Health. His heirs would have inherited substantial royalties and may have regretted his decision, but it is to Bailey's credit that he declined this generous offer, being aware that the leader was doing far more for him than he could ever do for her. On the 28th of August, in 1889, he signed a release absolving Mrs. Eddy from any further financial responsibility in his work. Eventually, the leader wrote Bailey that she had to discard all the work he had done and start over. But there is one remnant from his months of labor that remains to this day. That is his suggestion for the impersonalizing of the chapter entitled Reply to a Critic. In the next edition, that chapter became Some Objections Answered. As Mrs. Eddy's work for humanity progressed, the revision of the textbook grew in importance, and several students, in addition to Bailey, became involved with the work in one way or another. Helen and William Nixon. In the classroom of experience, not unlike other classrooms, the most capable students get the hardest problems. This was certainly the case with a young couple in Dakota Territory, Mr. and Mrs. William G. Nixon. Early in 1888, when they had just begun the study of Christian Science, their young son, Philip, passed away. But this severe trial was only the beginning of tribulation. Before another year had passed, they also lost their baby boy, 11-month-old Edward. The story of this latter trying time is told in the Journal of March, 1889, and discloses the hostility toward Christian Science, which was not uncommon during Mrs. Eddy's founding years. In their hometown of Pierre, Dakota, a Christian minister stirred up the people against the Nixons because they had forsaken their former church for Christian Science. The people prayed that God would take away their child, and little Edward was affected by the malicious thoughts. His mother and a friend worked and prayed constantly, and the baby rallied several times. But the hostility did not cease, and little Edward finally succumbed on the 25th of January in 1889. The press sent cruel, false reports across the nation, and the community threatened mob action. Even in her grief at this seeming defeat by animal magnetism, Mrs. Nixon wrote to the journal, quote, "Our trials have been severe, but we both stand fast. We are determined to demonstrate the nothingness of this seeming power." End quote. It could have been these words that caused the teacher to include Mrs. Nixon and her husband in the 1889 March primary class, which proved to be the last class taught by Mrs. Eddy before the close of the college. At the end of the session, in a conversation with these two young people, the teacher remarked to Mr. Nixon, quote, "If you should ever turn from Christian Science, you would become one of the strongest enemies it ever had." End quote. Perhaps she saw in this capable young man a strong sense of human will. Nonetheless, she had hope that his capabilities could be directed to accomplish good in the world, for she brought him to Boston in May to become publisher of the journal. In June, he became one of the 5-member publication committee responsible for this periodical when Mrs. Eddy gave it to the National Christian Scientist Association at their meeting in Cleveland, Ohio. Before the end of 1889, Nixon was appointed one of the 3 trustees to receive from Mrs. Eddy the land upon which to build the Boston Church. However, he had received a more important assignment earlier in the year. The leader had given him the responsibility for publishing the new revision of Science and Health upon which she was working. This assignment was perhaps the most important in the movement and a new departure for Mrs. Eddy, for she had been her own publisher for the first 48 editions with no help other than that of her husband, Asa Gilbert Eddy, on the 2nd and 3rd editions during the 5 short years of their marriage. The years since Asa Gilbert's participation had seen 45 editions, 2 of which were major revisions. And now, for the first time, she had a capable, experienced businessman to shoulder the burdens of the publishing aspect for the new major revision which was in progress. When Unity of Good had first been published in March of 1888, Mrs. Eddy had written to her student, Ellen Brown, that the book, quote, was needed or it would never have taken about 6 months to get published. The way is blockaded in proportion to the weight of good that is to be carried over it, end quote. The blockades in the way of the new edition of Science and Health seemed to increase rather than diminish as the work progressed. Perhaps it was the resistance she encountered which caused her to add this sentence to the chapter, Science of Being. Quote, "Until the author of this book learned the vastness of Christian Science, the fixedness of mortal illusions, and human hatred of truth, She cherished sanguine hopes that Christian Science would meet with immediate and universal acceptance. End quote. But she was the discoverer and founder. Her task was not only to discover the way, but to blaze the trail, to encounter the obstacles, and to overcome them. Thousands have followed along the path she blazed, but none has met with the obstacles she encountered, and few have any comprehension of the opposition to truth in her pioneering footsteps, nor of the magnitude of the founder's work in meeting and mastering this opposition. She no longer cherished sanguine hopes for the immediate acceptance of Christian Science, but she did precede that statement in this new revision with the words, quote, "Human resistance to divine science weakens in proportion as mortals give up error for truth, and the understanding of being supersedes mere belief." End quote. The added paragraph is titled Prospects. 1889 had been a year of trial from beginning to end. On the 2nd of January in the new year, Mrs. Eddy wrote to her students, Eugene and Grace Green, "The test of my dear students this year in following by faith the order of science is so sweet, so comforting to me, that but for this, it would have seemed insupportable to have borne the cross of the old year." Difficult as it had been, the cross of the old year did have its compensation in spiritual progress. On the 19th of January, she wrote to Clara Shannon, quote, "I have learned more of Christian Science the past year than I shall ever be able to communicate." End quote. But despite this great spiritual progress, the new year brought no relief. She looked for a respite early in April before discarding all of Bailey's work on the revision. And on April 10th, wrote to Helen Nixon, "My book, Revised Edition of Science and Health, is almost ready to go to press. It has been a difficult task to get it straightened out and right. The year that has gone is one not to be forgotten." Then a month later, she was practically starting all over again. Oftentimes, the helpers she employed were hinderers, and her capable young publisher, William Nixon, was no exception. A lengthy letter written to him on the last day of June discloses many areas of enemy attack through her students, but the following paragraphs touch upon those most pertinent to the work at hand. "I have never known a student of Christian Science who has not inclined to extremes, and it will take a long time, as it now appears, before Christian scientists will see and then take the intermediate course that I take, recommend to others, and have taught in the classroom. Jesus taught, and I teach, that there is in mortal mind a perpetual force impelling wrongly. You seem not to see this, and not to believe that constant watching is required in order to see it and then be able to put it down. If you have lost your interest in science and health and in working for God and humanity in the way you chose, please let me know at once. I am making a great effort and at a great pecuniary loss to get my revision perfect. I like you as a publisher of my book and hope you will go on with it. Nixon did go on with it, but his very business ability, which often helped the leader, was at times a hindrance to the progress of her work. Reverend James Henry Wigan. James Henry Wigan was an ex-Unitarian minister and a highly educated man, whom John Wilson employed as one of his proofreaders at the University Press. In that day, proofreaders were literary scholars with editorial ability. It was not only their function to discover errors, but to consult with authors on any point that might arise. John Wilson had printed Science and Health for Mrs. Eddy since 1881, beginning with the third edition, and it was he who first suggested that she employ Wigan for much-needed relief. Wilson knew that while she was shepherding the 16th edition, revised, through the steps of publication, she was at the same time the sole teacher at her college, the one Christian Science lecturer, and the pastor of her church. Help was very welcome, and one of Wigan's contributions at that time had been the addition of the index, which first appeared in the 16th edition. Mrs. Eddy had found Mr. Wigan exceptionally capable in the literary field, and she had a high regard for him. He also had a high regard for himself. Some of his acquaintances considered him a vainglorious, pompous man. He was a big man physically, with a keen intellect, a sharp wit, and a high opinion of his own ability. He and Mrs. Eddy at times disagreed, and many times she did not accept his advice. He may very well have felt that he could have improved Science and Health more than Mrs. Eddy did, but he laid no claim to being its author. That lie was put forth as one more attempt of evil to discredit the discoverer and founder. Mr. Reed, a key employee responsible for Mrs. Eddy's publications at University Press, wrote of this issue in his Random Recollections. When it was decided that it would be economy to have the copy prepared for the printer, thus saving charges for what would have been figured as alterations from copy, if done after the type had been set up, Mr. Wigan was detailed to do the work, punctuation, capitalization, and general smoothing out as to construction of sentences. And as he did this on his own time, the payment for these services was made by Mrs. Eddy, we having no interest in the matter. This was well known to those in our office, as well as in our proof reading department, and caused many a smile among us when we read from time to time the repeated assertion that Mr. Wigan had written the book, and it tickled him more than perhaps anyone else to read that he was the author instead of corrector. I frequently dined with Mr. Wilson and Mr. Wigan, and I can recall more than one occasion when the talk would turn on the topics of the day, Christian Science being then one of the leading subjects, the glee with which Mr. Wigan would refer to the suspicion that he was the author. And it would be some glee, as he had a laugh in keeping with his size, when he would say to Mr. Wilson, quote, "Wouldn't it have been fine if I had, and could give you all the printing?" End quote. The only portion remotely related to this lie was the 10-page section entitled Wayside Hints. When Mrs. Eddy had determined to cut 10 pages from the chapter on animal magnetism, just as the 16th edition was ready for production, Mr. Wiggin had been a great help with this last-minute change, and the 10-page filler, Wayside Hints, supplementary. The ideas in this supplement were wholly Mrs. Eddy's, but Wiggin had done much in reducing them to writing. She desired to acknowledge that fact in this new revision. However, mind directed otherwise, so instead the chapter was dropped, and her ideas were incorporated into the chapter Apocalypse. In April of 1890, when the new revision of Science and Health was almost ready to go to press, Mrs. Eddy again considered Wiggins's capabilities. In addition to his work on the 16th edition of her textbook, he had edited the Christian Science Journal for many months, when qualified students of science were either unavailable or were deserting the cause. His touch was professional, and his advice to Mrs. Eddy was always candid. So she decided to request his professional service once more and sent him proofs for the first chapter of the revision of Science and Health. His immediate response was that he would give her his frank appraisal as usual, quote, "and then, as usual, you will do as you please," end quote. His response, after perusing the material, may have been partially due to the fact that much that he had influenced her to add to the 16th edition, such as quotations from classic authors, was now being eliminated. Nevertheless, her own doubts regarding the rearrangement were confirmed by Wiggins's criticism. "I marvel at the deterioration your book has undergone in these reprinted pages. I should suppose a cyclone had struck the leaves and knocked them into unwanted corners. Better let your volume stand as it is. Too much change looks like vacillation." At this point, Mrs. Eddy abandoned all of the work that Mr. Bailey had done and started over, doing all the work herself and employing Mr. Wiggin to edit the new edition. His advice was to leave Science and Health as it was and to put the new material into a new book called Christian Science Restated. But his several urgings and arguments to that end were all in vain. Mrs. Eddy knew that the little book open in the hand of the angel was not to be pluralized. Her mission was the enlarging and perfecting of her presentation of this divine revelation. The obstacles encountered in the next several months are almost inconceivable, except to one who has pioneered a truly progressive step. Wiggins's work was invaluable, but he was often the channel for error. In a letter to her publisher on August 28th, Mrs. Eddy wrote, quote, "The second proofs have the most shocking flippancy in notations. I have corrected them, also made fewer of them, which will involve another delay caused by Mr. Wiggin," end quote. Several weeks later, in her November 3rd letter to Nixon, she stated, "There must be a change on my book printing. I have had only 15 pages of proof since October 10th, and Wigan will not send me what is in his hands that I have sent for. He promises, and that is all. This is malicious animal magnetism, and it governs Wigan as it has done once before to prevent the publishing of my work. The cause of all the problems and delays, reduced to its common denominator, was always malicious animal magnetism. And to meet the attacks of this one enemy, the leader called upon several of her staunchest workers. Captain Eastman was asked to do mental work specifically to help Mr. Wigan. But the captain wrote Calvin Fry in October that the thoughts the latter had sent him to work with were not strong enough to reach such a worldly man. A few days later, he wrote again that Wigan spoke publicly against Mrs. Eddy and that she should not employ the man that uttered such, quote, damnable blasphemy against our darling, end quote. Then added, quote, she is so good that maybe she has no idea of the badness of that or any man, end quote. It was true that Wigan ridiculed Mrs. Eddy in his own social circles, for though he recognized her ability and her spirituality, the arrogance of intellectualism kept him from supporting this whole-souled woman. One biographer has aptly stated that Wiggins's, quote, sense of intellectual superiority was clearly affronted by something in her that refused to be patronized, end quote. Mrs. Eddy's true superiority shines forth in her support of Wigan, despite his shortcomings. Although she criticized his actions when necessary to forward her work, she did not dwell on his mistakes or indiscretion and attempted to keep others from doing so. Her example and precept, ever and always, were to spare exposure as long as a hope remained of benefiting a man thereby. On the 9th of December, she wrote to Mrs. Nixon, I want to say that Mr. Wigan was probably in no way at fault. He is a man of as strict integrity as ever I dealt with, and I have known him in a business capacity for years. I esteem him very highly. The leader appreciated all that Mr. Wigan did for the perfecting of science and health, and was magnanimous in her praise of him. But she felt a deeper gratitude to the few dependable, dedicated students who supported her always to the best of their ability. Laura Ella Sargent. Laura Ella Sargent was 26 years old and in poor health in the spring of 1883 when she responded to the request of a friend from nearby Green Bay, Wisconsin, to join her in Milwaukee. The friend, Emma McDonald, was also a near invalid, but was rapidly regaining her health under the care of a Christian Science practitioner. Very soon, the two joyous women returned to their homes healed, with newly purchased copies of Science and Health. The following year, when Mrs. Eddy taught a class in Chicago, Laura Sargent and Emma McDonald were both in attendance. At the close of the class, the teacher said to Laura, quote, "This is not at all like my class in the college. and I should like you to come to Boston this fall and take the primary class there." End quote. Mrs. Sargent did so, and she returned to Boston many times at Mrs. Eddy's request, eventually in the capacity of personal companion in Mrs. Eddy's home. She was in that position in 1890, and also acting as courier, carrying Mrs. Eddy's completed pages of the revision of the textbook to the printer. It was during this time that Mrs. Sargent was witness to a most unusual occurrence. It was a fall morning, probably the 11th of November in 1890. Mrs. Eddy was in the habit of taking a morning stroll before beginning the day's work, and one of Laura's duties was to have her wraps in readiness. But on this particular morning, Mrs. Eddy was on the Mount of Revelation, even as was John on the Isle of Patmos. In after years, Laura stated that she had never before been in such a heavenly atmosphere, but at the time it was more than she could bear, and she was impelled to leave the room. Our leader was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, which can be glimpsed from what she wrote. But what Laura saw of this spiritual experience is as follows. As Laura entered the room, Mrs. Eddy was so absorbed in her writing that she did not notice Laura standing with her wraps. As several minutes went by, Laura began to sense the import of the occasion. The heavenly atmosphere was beyond anything she had ever experienced. She could not bear it long. She could not remain in this spiritual light. In like circumstances, Peter, James, and John fell on their face and were sore afraid. But Laura left the room. When she returned a little later, Mrs. Eddy was still writing, totally oblivious of anything else. Laura slipped her overshoes onto her feet, then left the room again, not returning until summoned by the bell a full hour or more later. The leader had Laura summon Calvin Fry and other members of the household, and when they were all seated in her room, she said to them, "I want to read you what God has given me this morning." Then she read them the closing paragraphs for her chapter, The Apocalypse, which are relatively unchanged from the 50th to her last edition in 1910. The Revelator had not yet passed the transitional stage in human experience called death, but he already saw a new heaven and a new earth. The beauty of this text is that the sum total of human misery, represented by the seven angelic vials, full of seven plagues, have full compensation in the law of love. Note this, that the very angel or swift-winged thought, which poured forth hatred and torment, brought also the experience which at last lifted the seer to behold the great city, whose four equal sides are heaven bestowed and heaven bestowing. Think of this, dear reader, for it will lift the sackcloth from your eyes, and you will behold the soft-winged dove presently descending upon you. This sacred city, described in the Apocalypse as one that lieth four square and cometh down from God out of heaven, represents the Alpha and Omega of divine science. As the psalmist saith, beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. This heavenly city, lighted by the sun of righteousness, this new Jerusalem, this infinite all, which to us seems hidden in the mist of remoteness, reached St. John's vision while yet he tabernacled with men. This holy habitation hath no boundary. This city of our God hath no need of sun or satellite, for love is the light thereof, and divine mind is its own interpreter. Its gates open towards light and glory, both within and without. For all is good, and nothing can enter that city which defileth or maketh a lie. Her beautiful face was radiant as she finished reading and announced that she was ready for her morning walk. "Will you bring me my overshoes?" she said to Laura. When told they were already on her feet, she asked in surprise, "When did you do that?" On the 12th of November, Mrs. Eddy wrote to Mrs. Nixon, "My last words for you all in the book Science and Health were written yesterday and sent off." Reverend Lanson P. Norcross. Lanson Norcross was not a founding member of the Oconto Christian Science Church, but became associated with it soon after it was started. In 1884, Laura Sargent began studying and practicing Christian Science in Oconto, Wisconsin, and it was little over 2 years later that she and her friends and associates erected the first Christian Science Church edifice in the world. With no pastor in their midst, Laura Sargent and Edwin Hart read passages from Science and Health and the Bible as their sermon, and closed their service by reading the Scientific Statement of Being. Reverend Norcross was a congregational minister serving his church in Bloomington, Illinois, when he volunteered his services to this new church. The scientists were happy to have a pastor, like other people. And it was the 2nd of September in 1888 when Norcross preached his first sermon in the Christian Science Church. That same month, Reverend Norcross enrolled in the Massachusetts Metaphysical College and attended the primary class taught by Mrs. Eddy, which convened on September 17th. The teacher found him to be earnest and sincere, although limited by his years of theological training. His belief in the power and comprehensiveness of his theological teaching vanished in one outburst when in the classroom Mrs. Eddy put some question to him and then worked him down to where all his arguments rested upon a single point, respecting which she asked a question that she knew he must answer rightly if he would be honest with himself and with her. He did not disappoint her expectation, and when the answer came, he burst out with the statement, "Then all my years of theological study don't amount to that," snapping his fingers. Mrs. Eddy laughed until the tears ran down her cheeks and all the class burst into merriment. But the beauty of the event was that everyone felt how charged Mr. Norcross was with honesty of purpose in the manliness of his admission. The merriment of the class was most kindly, for it spoke for the realization that here was an honest and fearless man, and he too, feeling the love of all, smiled and then broke into a hearty laugh. A year later, Mrs. Eddy had occasion to write to the Oconto Church. My beloved brethren, lips nor pen can ever express the joy you give me in parting so promptly with your beloved pastor, Reverend Mr. Norcross, to send him to aid me. It is a refreshing demonstration of Christianity, brotherly love, and all the rich graces of the Spirit. May this sacrifice bring to your beloved church a vision of the new church that cometh down from heaven, whose altar is a loving heart, whose communion is fellowship with saints and angels. This example of yours is a light that cannot be hid. She had called Reverend Norcross to Boston to become the pastor of the Mother Church in the fall of 1889 and to assist with the revision of Science and Health. It was he who compiled the index for this edition, while Wiggin worked on a new feature, marginal headings. It was also Reverend Norcross who was to announce the glad news from the pulpit early in 1891, when the revision of Science and Health was finally completed in all its perfectness and available to the people. The Jubilee. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound. In the Day of Atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. Leviticus. In her founding footsteps, the discoverer of Christian Science had published 48 editions of her textbook, Science and Health, presenting this divine message to the world with very little assistance and a great deal of resistance. In Retrospection and Introspection, she recounts that the work on the first edition had come to a standstill until she yielded to a constant conviction that I must insert in my last chapter a partial history of what I had already observed of mental malpractice. The resistance and persecution were even greater on the second and third editions, but she did have the assistance and companionship of her devoted husband, Asa Gilbert Eddy, during those few short years before his mental murder by her adversaries. But God is responsible for the mission of those whom he has anointed. And at the very nadir of her earth experience, she found a strength she had never known before, enabling her to go forward. She had also found a fine printer, John Wilson, who printed all her books from the third edition on. The sixth edition of the textbook and the 16th were both major revisions. And though she hired Wiggin to help with the latter, all of the publishing and financial burdens fell upon her shoulders. She made minor revisions in all editions, but the revision of 1890 was the next major revision, and it seemed as if all the artillery the enemy could muster was aimed at preventing its publication. She had begun the work in the fall of 1888, and with each passing month, her work had increased and intensified. Even though she had engaged a capable businessman to assume much of the work of publication, after 2 years of labor, the book still was not published. Many times on this project, she had felt that her 6 days of labor were ended, and she could enter into her Sabbath day of rest, only to have another hurdle thrown into her path. A letter to Mr. Nixon, her capable publisher, on December 18th, speaks of one more delay. "I was pleased at the prospect of the international bill whereby to derive advantages for the book about to be published by waiting for its passage until today. Now I have received different instructions from the source beyond human views. It was selfish in me to have entered into a human sense of gain. Push the book to as fast as possible completion. Some worldly poor Christian in England and elsewhere can publish it for the good of our race, or translate it with more facilities than we can in the old countries. Let them do it. It is God's book, and He says give it at once to the people. What is all this to thee? Follow thou me. Stealing it should be put down, but that is another thing that is a crime, and sin can do no good." Yet another letter to her publisher on the first day of 1891 was necessary before this hurdle was passed. "There is a great sin being committed by delaying or suffering my book, Science and Health, to be delayed for a money consideration. If the course is pursued, the unprecedented prosperity of this book that I have always conducted on the opposite basis will go down in the hands of those who do this. This I know. God's law, to feed my sheep, to give science and health at once to those hungering for it, must be obeyed and held paramount to an international law on copyright. Heed this, and rush with all your ability the publication of this work that the enemy is holding back." In meeting obstacle after obstacle, she learned as never before the allness of God. This higher revelation appeared on page 4 of the new revision in the words, "Thus it was that I beheld, as never before, the awful unreality called evil." At this point, a new word was inserted in Science and Health in the phrase, "the equipollence of God." Equipollence, according to Webster, is an equality of power or force, an equivalence between two or more propositions, that is, when two propositions signify the same thing, though differently expressed. Had this revision been published in the spring of 1889, it might have been the 49th edition. "But the Lord spake to Mary Baker Eddy, even as he had unto Moses in Mount Sinai. Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when ye come into the land which I give you, Then shall the land keep a Sabbath unto the Lord. 6 years shalt thou sow, and gather in the fruit thereof. But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest unto the land. And thou shalt number 7 Sabbaths of years unto thee, 7 times 7 years. And the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto thee 49 years. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound, and ye shall hallow the 50th year, and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a Jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family. For it is the Jubilee, it shall be holy unto you. This 49th edition of Science and Health had seen the 7 times 7 years of labor. The first edition in 1875 had led the children of Israel into the land of Christian Science. And now this new edition pointed the way more clearly than ever before to the city of our God. It was a cause for great rejoicing. It was truly the Jubilee. So, according to the chronological numbering, there is no 49th edition of Science and Health. The last edition before the revision was the 48th, but the new revision was numbered and called the 50th edition. Another message from our leader for us to ponder and fathom.